whether it be in the seminar room at Yale University, or in his writings, in books and articles, or in personal conversation, or in these lectures, each contact which I have had with our speaker has been productive in the realm of thought and action. Dr. James M. Gustafson, Professor of Religious Studies at Yale University, is one of the most able and articulate persons at work in the field of Christian ethics today. It has been our joy to have him for these days on our campus, and it's my personal privilege to present him this morning, Dr. Gustafson.
Thank you very much, Professor Bland. I can reciprocate your remarks and indicate the pleasure that has been mine and the profit that has been mine through our occasional contacts through the years. Yesterday, you'll recall, I addressed the question, why be moral? And I tried to show that if one is a Christian, then one believes certain things about God and God's relationship to man and to the world, and that on the basis of these beliefs, there was an imperative to be engaged in morality, in moral action. Now this morning, what I want to discuss is whether the Christian beliefs that we have about God, about man in his relationship to God, and about man in his relation to others, whether Christian beliefs, ideas, assertions, concepts, confessions, whether these make any particular difference in the determination of the conduct that we engage in. There is a kind of setting for my lecture this morning, which perhaps is not the sort of setting that some of you live in day by day, but it's a setting that comes out of debates between philosophers and theologians as to whether religious beliefs make any distinctive difference in one's moral conduct, or whether the religious man, in determining what he should do in his moral conduct, has the same principles, the same values that other people have, only they arrive at them from a different path. So the burden of my lecture this morning is to try to look at the ways in which the particularities of Christian belief enter into the determination of our conduct in such a way that we might, under certain circumstances, be called upon to do different things than other people are called upon to do, or we might do our things, the activities in which we are engaged, with a different kind of nuance, and certainly at least with a different interpretation of their significance. Now, I want to pursue the answer to the question of whether Christian beliefs make any difference in the determination of conduct by looking at two aspects of what goes into the determination of our decisions about what we ought to do under particular circumstances. One aspect of deciding what we ought to do, whether we're Christian or anybody else, one aspect of this is the way in which all of us are called upon in a particular set of circumstances to give an evaluative description of what is going on at that particular time and at that particular place. That is to say, if we are a physician and if we are dealing with a patient who is terminally ill, and if we are entertaining the possibility of withdrawing life support systems, part of what goes on in the decisions that we make is what really is the set of circumstances relative to this patient under these conditions. And this isn't merely a medical description at that point. It's a description which has certain kinds of values packed into it. So the first aspect of the determination of our conduct that I want to talk about then is what I call the evaluative description of the circumstances, what is going on in a particular place. And I'm going to want to show how certain theological concepts, certain religious beliefs enter into the Christian's evaluative description of the circumstances of action. The second aspect of deliberation is the formation of our purposes or our intentions in deciding how we are going to exercise the powers that we have available to us as we act with reference to those circumstances. That is to say, I'm assuming here that there is a rational side of human conduct, that people do formulate intentions and purposes about what they hope to achieve in their moral actions in a particular set of circumstances. And then, you see, I will want to look at the ways in which particular Christian beliefs enter into the formulation of our particular purposes and actions as members of the Christian community in our moral behavior. Now, first of all, then, let us look a little bit more then at what goes into this process of what I call an evaluative description of the circumstances. Let me describe what I'm getting at in using that rather awkward phrase by talking a little bit about the war in Vietnam. I suppose everybody in this room, every individual in this room, has some kind of rather firmly determined response to the war in Vietnam by this time. Now, the way in which we are to determine our moral responses to the war in Vietnam is itself determined in part by what we think is going on in Vietnam, by a picture we draw of the Vietnam War. And just as any picture drawn by an artist leaves some things out and highlights other things, so our picture of the war in Vietnam accents certain features of what is going on and shadows other features of what is going on. And so our moral response to the war in Vietnam is to a considerable extent conditioned by the beliefs or the convictions or the concepts that we have in taking out of all that raw data that isn't very raw when it comes to us anyway through news reports, but taking out of all that raw data an image, a set of contours as to what that war is, and then we respond not actually to the war as it's fought day by day, but we respond with our moral judgments to the picture that we have of what is going on. And what I want to get at in terms of the evaluative description of the circumstances is what goes into drawing that picture. Now let me continue the illustration of the war in Vietnam for a moment. If, you see, one reads all that he can about it and talks to people about it, and if on the basis of that reading and talking and hearing, one decides that the war in Vietnam is really a war between a demonic power seeking to suppress all the human values that make life worthy of living, all the humane values that provide dignity to man, on the one hand, and if on the other hand, the other side of that war is a righteous cause in which one feels the moral requirement or one sees the necessity to overcome those demonic forces of evil, one has quite a moral, clear-cut moral choice before him. The war is a clear-cut choice between the forces of evil and the forces of good. Because one describes and interprets the war in those terms, one's moral judgment about the war, if that were an accurate description, you see, would be clear enough. If it's that kind of a war between the forces of utter demonry and the forces of good, all of us, of course, want to be on the side of good. But if, you see, we take the same set of raw data and interpret it in the light of another set of concepts, we will get another picture of that war, and by getting another picture of that war, our responses will be different. Let me take the antithesis to the description I gave a moment ago. If we read about that war and decide that what's going on in Vietnam is a war of national liberation on the part of people who have for hundreds of years been oppressed and suppressed by imperial powers from outside of their own territory who have been dominating and exploiting them. If that's what it is on the one side, and on the other side it is the imperial exploitation of a people who do not have the political and military power to achieve the freedom which they deserve, if that's what it is on the other side, if we describe the war that way in an evaluative way, see, we have another kind of picture of the war on our hands. Now, my point here is that in any particular set of circumstances, the way in which we formulate the picture of those circumstances is in part informed by certain kinds of moral convictions that we have, certain kinds of beliefs that we have, so that the person who is likely to interpret the war in that latter evaluative description is a person who is very sensitive, let's say, as many people rightfully are in our time, to the oppression of minority peoples and so forth by dominant powers. He's a person who has a tremendous sense of social justice, and by virtue of these kinds of experiences and these kinds of concepts and beliefs, he interprets the war differently, let us say, than somebody who sees communism as a totally demonic force of evil that has to be suppressed if all humane values are to be preserved. There are moral elements that go right into the description of the circumstances. Now, what I want to look at now is the ways in which, in Christian thinking about the various circumstances in which we live, certain concepts that come out of our beliefs about God, our beliefs about man in relation to God, the way in which these concepts enter into the way in which Christians assess and evaluate the circumstances of their action in such a way that one frames a picture of what is going on in the course of action. One frames a picture in such a way that that picture in part determines what one decides to do relative to that. Let me go at it with a couple of illustrations. We can put the question quite precisely in this way. Do religious beliefs provide concepts that are used in the interpretation of what is going on in such a way that one's own conception and evaluation of what is going on is nuanced or biased in favor of certain sorts of judgments? My answer to that question is yes. That one of the ways in which religious Christian theological beliefs enter into the determination of conduct is the use of concepts, the use of ideas out of theology for the interpretation of what is going on in the circumstances to which we are called upon to relate. Let me illustrate that quite simply with the notion of man as sinner. This certainly has been one of the more effective ways in which the late Reinhold Niebuhr had such a wide impact upon Christian ethical thinking. That is to say, a theological conception about the nature of man, if I may use a metaphor for a moment, provided a man like Reinhold Niebuhr with a set of spectacles, which were slightly colored, I think we would have to say, a set of colored glasses, which in a sense highlighted certain features of human activity about what was going on in the struggles for power between one group and another group in society, about what was going on in the minds of well-intentioned people when they went out and sought to do good. That is to say, the nature of man understood in his own way as man as sinner provided him a pair of spectacles by which he saw the world differently from the way in which somebody would see the world without those spectacles or with a different set of spectacles on. Man is sinner, he does not trust in God. Because he does not trust in God, he is curved inward upon himself. He is full of anxiety because of his lack of faith. To overcome his anxiety, what does he do? He slips into a life of sensuality on the one hand, in which he denies the capacities of his spirit, or he slips into a life of pride on the other hand, in which he has to shape false gods out of his moral judgments and out of the powers that he deals with. And by interpreting political affairs, by interpreting social affairs in the light of this kind of a concept, certain aspects of what goes on in American political life, in American social life, are, we might almost say, revealed in a new light to us. And so we, in turn, respond to what is going on in the light of that picture of those events as that picture is drawn through a certain set of theological spectacles. So that one could cite in many examples Reinhold Niebuhr's arguments against pacifism in the 1930s. What was wrong with the pacifists? The pacifists viewed the world in such a way that they assumed that man's capacities for righteousness and goodness would triumph, so that subsequently men would be able to live together in pure rationality, harmony, and peace. And what happened when one viewed the world with these sort of rosy-hued glasses? See, one misunderstood that nation states are seeking power to secure their boundaries against threats. One misunderstood that political parties are not out for the common good, but are frequently out to seek to dominate certain groups in the society for the sake of the advantages of the persons who run the political parties. One misunderstood that there are forces of evil in the world that are strong enough to overcome the forces of good. Why did one misunderstand that? Because the glasses that the American pacifist of the 30s had colored out evil in such a way that one did not see it. So that theological beliefs, you see, in this case, beliefs about man the sinner, theological beliefs enter into the way in which we evaluatively describe what the circumstances are that are going on. I think we've seen this dramatically without reference to theology. In the last 4 or 5 years, with reference to the relations between blacks and whites in our society. That is to say, in the integrationist days of the mid-60s and early 60s, what kind of view of man in the world did one have? One had a view of people being able to transcend the differences in their color, in their cultural backgrounds, in a way being able to deny the particularities of their cultural backgrounds, and moving towards a kind of common humanity in which we would all live together in perfect peace and harmony and have perfect mutual respect for each other. But what did one begin to find as black people became awakened to the pride of consciousness in their own color and to the necessity for black power? What one saw was that black people don't see the world in the same way that those of us of a privileged caste in our society see the world, that there are reasons for not trusting people who seem to view the world in such a way that one finds an ideal goal of perfect peace and harmony and equanimity, transcending differences, and etc. That is to say, black people achieved a kind of consciousness of their own particularity and identity, which in turn, you see, enables them to read what is going on in every city in America and in the country as a whole in a very different way from the integrationist mentality of the white. Their experience in this case leads them to interpret the events in a different way. So that one set of people can look at the Soledad brothers in San Quentin and say one sort of thing is going on. Blacks can look at the Soledad brothers and the incidents in San Quentin and suspect that something very different is going on. Why? Because they have different experiences and different beliefs, which lead them to interpret this, what is going on, in a different way, and in turn this colors their participation in the events in a different way. Now, it's not only the doctrine of sin which can be used to give a kind of theological interpretation of what is going on. The theological speculations of Father Teilhard de Chardin, for example, provide certain sorts of concepts by which certain Catholics have sought to understand what is going on, not merely with reference to a particular occasion on which they must act, but with reference to the whole evolutionary development of humanity. Teilhard could talk, you see, in his combination of scientific information and vision, religious vision, he could talk about how the human development is leading on towards that omega point towards which it inevitably is moving, and that in this process of human history something is going on. It is a process of increasing personalization as against depersonalization of relationships with one with another. It is a process of amorization, a process of growing relationships of love as man evolves towards the omega point. Indeed, he can talk about it as a process of Christification, of a kind of imbuing into the evolutionary process those truths about man and the destiny of man which are made known to people in the figure of Jesus Christ. And life is going on towards that end. Now just imagine for a moment, you see, if you were totally convinced that this was a theologically viable way of viewing the world, what would you do then? You would look at historical events, or you would look at what is going on in the biological sciences, and you would be prone to say, well, there are problems. Teilhard certainly understood there was evil in the world. There are problems in human development which, to be sure, will thrust us back for periods of time from that onward projection of our lives towards the omega point. Yes, that's true. But we are, if one's a true believer in these concepts, you see, we are in a process of Christification, of amorization. The world is moving towards an omega point. And what does this do? This provides one not only with a way of highlighting certain things that one sees. Ah, here's evidence of amorization. Ah, here's evidence of further Christification. But it also provides one with standards or criteria by which he judges other things to be wrong in the circumstances that he's responding to. That is to say, oh, here's evidence that amorization is being blocked by the way in which human beings are related to each other. And if amorization, the concept used to interpret what is going on, is being blocked here, then there's something wrong with this set of circumstances. There is an evaluative description of them in such a way that one says something is not right at this particular point. One could cite other concepts used in theology as well. But I hope my point is clear, that to have certain Christian beliefs which one articulates in the forms of theological statements and concepts, and to have these concepts utilized, perhaps even internalized into one's very perceptual apparatus as one looks at the world, to have these concepts utilized in the interpretation of what is going on biases us towards doing certain things. If, you see, to go back to the Reinhold Niebuhr, if one finds in this process of the interpretation of events in the light of the doctrine of man as sinner, that one has a heightened awareness of the forces of evil that are at work in the world, it is consistent with this evaluative interpretation of events to determine one's own action as the necessity to resist the forces of evil. Or to take the contrast you see with Teilhard de Chardin, if one sees the evolutionary process as a process of gradual Christification, then in a sense what is one called upon to do? One is called upon to interpret the world in the light of that ongoing process, and one's action then is in a sense to get with that process and to move it towards those particular ends. So point number one then is that religious beliefs provide concepts. Indeed, one could use the metaphor, they provide spectacles by which we perceive what is going on in the world, by which we determine the contours of the meaning of the events in which we participate, and the way in which we picture those events, the way in which we image forth those events as the result of seeing them through particular sets of religious beliefs, in a sense, predisposes us to respond to events in one way or in another way. Let me take just one moment for another type of distinction in this regard. Not theological, but I think it'll reinforce the point. In work in medical ethics, for example, one finds people who sometimes don't articulate it, but nonetheless have a profound conviction that the individual rights of individual persons ought to be protected under all circumstances. One finds also in medical ethical discussions people who have a profound conviction that what ought to be sought under all circumstances in medical care is the greatest good of the greatest number over the longest period of time. Now, it makes a difference how you view any particular problem in medical ethics, whether you view it with a belief in the sanctity of individual rights, or whether you view it with a belief in the greatest good for the greatest number. Should hospitals have the right to harvest kidneys so they can be transplanted into feast persons who need kidneys. If one views that possibility from individual rights, one interprets this what? One interprets this as a violation of the right of the dying person or his family to determine what ought to be done with his body. One sees that as the most important factor in the picture of things. But if one views that set of circumstances in terms of trying to do the greatest good for the greatest number of people over the longest period of time, then what does one have? One has primarily a vision of all those people who need kidneys. See? And because one has that vision, then one denigrates the rights of individual persons and says, in effect, hospitals ought to have the right to take kidneys from dying persons regardless of the determination of the dying person or the family relative to the needs of the greatest good of the greatest number. Now, my point is, you see, that theological beliefs have the same kinds of consequences when used seriously in drawing a picture of what is happening and then in turn predisposing us by virtue of the picture that we see to one set or one way of acting or another way of acting. Now let me go on to suggest then the second way in which, second aspect of what goes into the determination of conduct. And that aspect is to determine our own purposes, determine what we ought to do in the exercise of our powers as we proceed to act in a particular set of circumstances. My point is, do religious beliefs, let me put it this way, do religious beliefs about God and his purposes for man provide a basis for inferring that certain moral principles and certain human values are more in accord with those religious beliefs than are other moral principles and other moral values? To restate the question, because I believe in God as he has made himself known in the community of Israel and in Jesus Christ and the Christian tradition, are there certain inferences I draw from that belief towards a significant degree of higher authority for me of certain moral values or certain moral principles than those moral values and principles would have if I did not believe in God who has made himself known through the community of Israel and its history and through Christ and through the Christian tradition? Can one infer moral principles from Christian beliefs in such a way that those are particular moral principles because of the particular Christian beliefs from which they are inferred? One of my favorite passages in Scripture for just thinking this question out is from the first Johannine epistle, the example of love. Let's confine ourselves for a moment to an illustration drawn from Scripture, an illustration which I think indicates the ways within Scripture itself certain principles and values are inferred from religious beliefs. You all recall the passage, 1 John 4. Well, I suppose it's one of the great passages on love, at least equal to 1 Corinthians 13, if not surpassing it, in theological profundity and dignity, I believe. Now, that passage in 1 John 4 is not developed with a kind of logical order that a present theologian and logician might wish to develop it. But I don't think we radically distort that passage if we use it as an illustration of how the community did find certain values to be more consistent with religious beliefs than other values, and therefore gave those values primacy in their own interpretation of what life ought to be like. It's not developed in a logical sequence so that the premise comes before the conclusions in the writer of the account of the letter's own work. I suppose many of us wish that sometimes that St. Paul and St. John had had courses in logic, but then I think other times we're glad they didn't because they are much more interesting, perhaps richer because they didn't. But surely if one looks at this passage, what does one have? One has the flat, outright assertion that God is love. Now, let us say that we as a community believe that to be true. That's a statement about God. The predicate love is a fitting statement, description of the subject, God. Now, if we do not believe that that is true, If we do not believe that that is true, what is drawn from that is not necessarily persuasive to us. That is to say, if we do not believe it is true, we would probably not agree that men ought to love one another. Now, we might agree that men ought to love one another if we didn't believe that God is love, but we might not believe that men ought to love one another if we didn't believe that God is love. But because we believe that God is love, we put a because in there. God is love, therefore, we ought to love one another. If one does not believe that to be true, what follows is not necessarily persuasive. One might believe that persons ought to love one another, but one would believe it for different reasons, to go back to what I said yesterday, than what are stated in the text. I'm not trying to say that one cannot believe in love as a principle of evaluation of circumstances, or love as a principle of the determination of his own purposes, unless one believes in God. What I am trying to show is that if one shares the Christian belief that God is love, then there is a priority to some kind of conception of love in the determination of the conduct, the moral conduct, of the members of the Christian community. The passage, you will recall, indicates, among other things, that man knows that God is love because God has loved man in a deed in which he has done in man's behalf. This would tie into what I said yesterday, you see, that there is, in a sense here, an ethic of the imitation of God at work. Because God has loved us, we know of God's love, and we are to imitate God's love. And because God is a God of love, not a God of hate, not primarily a God of wrath, certainly not a God of vindictiveness, not simply a God who sort of fatefully determines the course of events in the world without any kind of qualitative aspects to his moral will, because he is not that kind of God, but is a God of love, there is a particular requirement on the Christian community to pay attention to love as a moral value or as a principle determining its conduct. If God so loved us, we ought to love one another. If God loved us, we ought also to love God. If anyone says, "I love God," and hates his brother, he is a liar. And that, in a sense, is one of the more interesting things about it. That is to say, see, if you believe in God as a God of love, it rules out certain kinds of action. One cannot, and or certain kinds of attitudes. One cannot hate his brother and be consistent with his belief in the love of God. One is then a liar, see. What I'm suggesting here is that some things in human life, some moral principles and values that some people might hold under certain circumstances, some values, ends that they might have, are so inconsistent with professed religious beliefs in a God of love that it almost becomes a test of their faith. They are liars if they hate their brother and believe that God is love. Now, if you turn that around, then you say, well, then there are certain attitudes towards one another and certain principles that ought to govern human behavior which are consistent with fundamental beliefs about God. And because there is a consistency between these principles or these moral attitudes or these moral values and certain fundamental things believed about God, that God is love, then these principles ought to have a kind of primacy in the determination of the conduct of the Christian community. Now, how can a religious belief such as God is love become the basis for inferring that certain moral values or principles are normative? How can that happen? How does one move to saying things about God to saying things about what one ought to do with reference to men? This can be done because the things we believe about God are not merely predicates to the subject God, but the things we believe about God are beliefs about what God wills for man, what God has done for man, what God intends that man should be and should do. So it's not it's nothing magical about saying, I believe about this about God, and therefore, somehow or another, through some process, I can infer that I ought to do this with reference to man. No, to say that God is love is, in effect, to say that God loves man. And by saying that God loves man, then we've already, in a sense, put a moral element into our understanding of the belief about the love of God, and in terms of this, then we've introduced the possibility of moving more logically and more clearly from a belief about God to a belief about what man ought to be doing. See, again, I can cite an example from Reinhold Niebuhr. You'll recall in Moral Man and Immoral Society, Niebuhr fixes upon the crucifixion as the revelation of the self-sacrificial love, and then in turn that self-sacrificial love revealed in the cross becomes normative for man so that he can say that self-sacrificial love is the law of life. Now, it strikes one odd if one isn't brought up in a kind of religious context to look at a man hanging on a cross with nails and then say from that historical event of a man crucified that something there is revealed about the law of life. An historical event suddenly is revelatory of the fundamental structure and intention of human history. But how can Niebuhr make this connection? He can make this connection because when he views that event of a Christ upon the cross, there is already in his viewing and his belief of its significance a kind of moral content to it. That is to say, it isn't simply an event without meaning, it is an event with meaning about what God wills that man should be able to be and to do in his own life. So that he can look at the crucifixion and say, it isn't just that a man is sacrificed there as a result of a judicial decision, but the sacrifice of that man reveals self-sacrificial love. Self-sacrificial love reveals something about what man is called to be if man believes in God who reveals himself in the form of self-sacrificial love by the death of his son upon a cross. So that the cross becomes then, you see, a way of disclosing what our intentions and our purposes ought to be. There's a kind of moral norm about the nature of love for Reinhold Niebuhr, which is derived from a belief about an historical event. Because God is the sort of God who makes himself known and makes his love known more clearly in self-sacrifice than in any other thing, it seems to me Niebuhr is saying. Because he is that sort of God, that revelation of his love is a clue to what man's life ought truly to be. And therefore, you see, on the basis of that religious belief, all our other loves are judged in the light of the norm of the requirement of self-sacrificial love, as what agape is all about. See, religious beliefs become a basis for inferring that certain principles and certain values have primacy for the morality of the Christian community. Now we can ask ourselves, does the religious belief that God is love affect any distinctive accents to a norm for our participating in moral life? Or does that word love become so vacuous that we, now that we've got it, we just sort of balloon it up with whatever we please to put into that? I think that there are distinctive accents, and I would stick with the cross at this point. I think there are distinctive accents to the meaning of love for the Christian community by virtue of the religious beliefs it has about love and love revealed in the death of Christ. That is to say that one, in a sense, infers from the significance of that event for our own purposes and intentions that if we believe in that event being significant, we ought, to go the second mile. To give the cloak as well as the coat, or the coat as well as the cloak, whichever it is, I don't recall for a moment. We ought to be prepared to be engaged in self-sacrificial love, that our life ought to be, in the great kenotic passages, a life of service, etc., etc. See, because we believe that God is love and God reveals himself in sacrificial love of Christ, then we ought to be a community which is morally willing to run certain risks of cost to ourselves as individual persons seeking the benefit of the neighbor or of the whole community. We ought to not only do that as individual persons, but as a community of Christians, we ought to be willing, see, to go the second mile, to do the costly deed, to be the form of the servant with reference to men, etc. There is an accent to the understanding of a command of love which has its own particularities because that accent is sounded forth out of particular religious beliefs. Now, there are a lot of religious beliefs about God that function in the same way, and part of the problem in practical Christian ethical discourse is to show, yes, God is love, but God is also just. And so what is the relationship between God's justice and God's love, etc., in relation to what we ought to do? I don't have time to get into those. I want to make one more point by asking another kind of question. Is there ever an occasion in which a particular religious belief requires such a specific moral act on the part of the believer that the only way to defend that act is by saying, that act I defend only because it is faithful to my religious beliefs and not because it would be morally right on any other circumstances? This gets back to a door I opened yesterday and quickly closed. That is to say, are the commands of God right because God commanded them, or are the commands of God right because God wouldn't command a command that is not right? See? Now my point here is there ever an event, an occasion, in which one could not say about an act that a Christian decided to do, one could not say, yes, I can justify that on natural, rational, moral grounds? Or will there be an occasion which he can say, I had to do that because and only because of my religious beliefs? Now, this is an old problem. I think it's a problem in Scripture, as we at least have the texts, for example, in the Holiness Codes in the book of Leviticus. To be sure, in the light of Near Eastern history, there are other ways of understanding the accumulation of these codes, but as we have these codes in Leviticus, for example, we see this. None of you shall approach anyone near to his kin, near of kin to him, to uncover nakedness. I am the Lord. Now, we might look at this for a moment. We say that, well, this is a rule against incest. Now, why is incest wrong in this rule? It appears, you see, if one reads the text flatly on the face of it, that the violation is wrong because it is commanded by God. God has commanded that no one should uncover those who are near kin to him. Thus, what is wrong about incest is that it violates a command of God. It is not wrong, see, on independent moral grounds, that form of sexual behavior is wrong, and therefore God commanded it. This would leave open the possibility, on the basis of this kind of sort of foolish prima facie exegesis, this would leave open the possibility that incest would not be morally wrong if God had not said it was wrong. So that there's a sense in which in this passage you say, why is incest wrong? Not because it leads to genetic malformities in future generations, not because I have an innate distaste for it or I find it repulsive, and therefore it appeals to something wrong in the moral law. It's wrong for a religious reason. It is morally wrong for a religious reason. Namely, God commanded that one ought not to commit incest. Now, you see, what I'm asking is there ever any situation like that? I suppose none of us would say that about incest today, or even about murder. Murder is wrong simply because God commanded that it's wrong. We could find other reasons for it as well. I want to cite, in closing, one instance in which I believe, at least one instance, in which I believe that conscientious moral Christians give only a religious reason for a moral position that they take. And I want to look at a little bit now, in closing, at the Christian absolute pacifist. The Christian absolute pacifist who believes that the exercise of physical coercion, which might lead to the taking of life, is morally wrong. Because why? Because it violates his religious beliefs. This is really the grounds, depending on how religious belief is interpreted these days, on which one can get conscientious objector status. Now, the difference between a Christian confessional pacifist and another pacifist lies precisely in terms of why one is a pacifist. The non-confessional pacifist might say, yes, I believe that any kind of physical coercion which may lead to the taking of life is wrong. Why? Because people would really be happier if they didn't go around killing each other, etc., etc. Now, the confessional pacifist might want to say those things as well, but the confessional pacifist would not ultimately justify the moral principle of his pacifism on the basis of the fact that it could be universalized, that if everybody behaved this way, men would be better off. But rather, he would justify his pacifism on the basis of his religious beliefs, that is to say, his religiously informed conscience, which is to say, I cannot be engaged in any activity which may lead to killing. Why? Because it is a violation of God's love. It is a violation of God's law. It is his religious beliefs that authorize him, ultimately, to judge that certain things are morally wrong for him to do. He may or he may not go on to say that they are also morally wrong for other people to do, but they are morally wrong for him to do because there is a profound inconsistency, you see, between that sort of moral activity and the religious beliefs that he holds. So my point is that there are occasions in which a belief determines very particularly and precisely what the Christian in his conscience can and cannot do. What I hope then that I've been able to do this morning is to suggest, as yesterday I tried to show religious reasons for being moral, today I've tried to show that the religious reasons we have for being moral enter into the determination of how our moral our moral action takes place. And it enters into it in two ways. One, by providing concepts and beliefs which become, in a sense, the spectacles by which we see the world and define the situations to which we respond. And secondly, it becomes determinative to some extent of our moral actions because there are certain purposes, certain principles, certain values which have a higher degree of consistency with our religious beliefs than others. And if we take our religious beliefs seriously, then certain principles and values have primacy for us, and therefore religious beliefs enter into the determination of our conduct under particular sets of circumstances.